I'm Ray Coob.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And it's always fun, Marcus, when we get to talk to a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even though, you know, we don't always give them the highest grades, right?
It is always wonderful talking with somebody of that caliber of a musician or that high of a level of a musician, because we know that we're going to learn something. And somebody like Denny Lane, who has done so much over his life, always has great stories to share. And those stories will include some learning as well. So it's going to be a blast talking to Denny.
Guests like him always surprise us in one small or large way when we get to talking here on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. We want to thank our sponsors, as always, for supporting this podcast coming up on 40 years. How did we get here, man? How did we get here?
I know.
And we are so happy, thrilled, actually, if you want to know the truth, Denny, to have Denny Lane on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll, Ray and Marcus, with a million questions, but we'll be brief.
You better be.
Hey, first off, I got to tell you, you haven't been on our podcast before. I want to congratulate you and everyone involved in the effort in getting the Moody Blues into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was way overdue, Denny, and your role in the band, getting them on track as the original progressive band, I view the Moody Blues as, your role in all that, and how hard it was, how much the fans had to push for it. I'm happy that it finally happened.
Not only that, but at first I wasn't included, so that's the story.
But you were there, right?
Eventually.
Is that old history kind of catching up to the modern times, or was somebody just being foolish?
I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just saying, if that's what you want to talk about first, I can talk about it.
But, sure. That's the kind of stuff that people don't really understand. And I guess it's a little sensitive for us as fans of yours to ask about it. But how'd that all get worked out and what was going on?
Well, originally, you know, I don't get myself too involved in this, but, you know, the details of how things come together. But I know for a fact that, you know, we were due to go in because of Go Now. And Go Now is the only number one the Moody's ever had.
We've already said
So I was told that that was the stipulation. You had to have a number one.
And that's you.
Yeah. So originally I wasn't invited. So I had a couple of friends of mine, like in the business, who complained on my behalf. And I won't go into the names, but they're pretty big names. And eventually I got the call to say, oh, yes, we want you to come along to be inducted. So I didn't say anything. I just went and did it. But originally, I did ask Ray Thomas, actually, months before, and he passed away shortly before this anyway. He said, oh, no, we weren't anything to do with that. Because I was told that maybe it was the band's decision as to who goes, you know.
Mm.
So I thought, well, I don't care anyway. But eventually he said, no, it wasn't our decision. So eventually they did call me to get me to go. So I just went along with it, you know.
Did it piss you off at all that by the time they got around to doing it, Ray wasn't here to be part of it?
It upset, of course, and that would have been, I mean, we've stayed in touch with his wife and everything, so, you know, we're pretty close to them. So, it was very upsetting, and of course, she came, and everybody felt bad for her, but she came, and so did all the other people, and I enjoyed it, actually. It was nice. I'd met Justin before. I'd even done a TV show with him before. John Lodge, I didn't really know, even though I know he worked with Ray Thomas in Birmingham originally in his band. And he was a first choice for the bass player for the Moody Blues, but he was at college and whatever, and didn't want to move down to London. So that was the answer there. So when I left, of course, he came in, but I didn't really know John. So I got to know him a little bit, and he was
a real nice guy.
And then Justin was great. It was nice. I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed the trip.
Excellent. Over this long storied Hall of Fame rock and roll life that you have lived, you have shared the stage with so many musicians, in like crazy numbers of great musicians. Is there anybody that you did not get to share the stage with that you had always wanted to?
No, not really, because I don't look at it like I want to share stages with people. But by accident or whatever it is, I have, you know, some of my heroes. I mean, Chuck Berry was the first tour we ever did, and that was fantastic. That's when he even used my amplifier, my Gibson Titan amplifier.
He was famous for that, right? Just plugging into what was there and going.
But we didn't back him up. Saying that, we enjoyed being around these people. So Sonny Boyce, Chuck Berry, Don Everly, I enjoyed doing the thing with him at the Albert Hall. You know, the Everly Brothers I met prior to another date in Vegas, and they came up with our band and did a little song just to promote their show that was coming up the next day. People like that. Don't want your love anymore. Don't want your kisses, that's for sure. Who I didn't choose to be around, but were just there, you know. So it's like you don't know what's going to happen on the day, do you? You know, that's the way it goes.
Now, we're getting to talk to you today because you're doing dates and for a few weeks in February in the United States. Tell us about the format, what you're doing, what's going on with your tour.
What I'm doing is I'm doing my songs that I either wrote, co-wrote, did four different things I was involved with. That would have been really not my own band, because never used to do it in them days. But, you know, Wings, Moody Blues, a string band I had, and then solo records that I had out in the 80s. So I'm doing some songs that people don't even know unless they're big fans. I'm also...
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them? was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
So doing some wing stuff that I was on and co-wrote and stuff like that. I'm not trying to do a Paul McCartney here. Let's get that straight. I'm not trying to be, sing Wings hits that I wasn't really the singer on. But, I'm getting across the fact that me and him used to write together and hang out together and knew him way before I joined Wings. So it's all that story. There's stories involved with the actual writing of songs and what songs mean. And also say to people, if you want to know what I'm all about, just get to know the lyrics of the songs. That's the kind of stories I'm telling. So it's the songs and stories. I try to keep it as brief as possible so I can get all the songs in. I mean, I've got a couple of hours worth of songs there, see? So that's what it is, and it's just me and a guitar.
It's but a chance for fans to get to know you musically and intimately in a nice setting at the venues you're playing. There's one, Ram's Head, which people know down in Annapolis, but it's pretty much the city winery tour with New York and Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, and Chicago. And what we're going to do is put links to your tour dates, all of our stuff, for our episode with your visit here on the Imbalance History. So we'll get it all covered so people know where to go and see you when they're in town.
Well, that's it. That's what I'm doing. And I've actually done it before the pandemic. I started doing this for about, on and off, a few months. I dropped the band thing and just went completely, solo. And enjoyed it so much that that's what I've started to do again. If I have to run, I'm not running out on you. If I have to shake, stand out of my shoes. Running from the law, oh, that put me inside. Baby, won't you let me have a little time to hide?
I did a tour, actually, a Beatles sort of bass tour with Todd Rundgren and Christopher Cross and that. But that really wasn't my tour. I was just a guest on that tour.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
But as far as me doing my own shows, I hadn't really worked since the pandemic. So, the fact that I'm out there doing it again now, and, I tried one out the other night and it went down really well. So I managed to get everything in there and it was a good night, It's a sort of a tester and people like it, They just, as you say, it's more of an intimate thing and it's fun for me. I can move it around if I want to.
During the pandemic, which you mentioned, how did you get through the day? How did you manage to get through and keep music happening in your day?
I live out in the country. In Florida. So, I kind of cut myself off, I was writing songs and recording ideas and stuff like that. I spoke to Paul about, this was all about the vaccine situation. And at the time, I didn't believe in it. And he said, you should get it, man. It's the only way you're going to get any work, which is true. And so I did. And then that's when I started working then to do that tour, But really, I kept myself to myself because on that tour, we all caught a short version of COVID. And I had a pretty bad time of it, not at first, but then after a while. And so, I was very wary about going out and being around anybody at the time. So that's the way it's been. And now I'm going out to do it. I'm not so worried about it. I've kind of been through the worst part of that. But a lot of my friends had a bad time with that COVID thing.
beat people up pretty hard. You talked about putting together a couple hours worth of music for this upcoming tour. Was putting that playlist together difficult, or did you really have an idea in mind when you set the stories up?
Well, it's always the songs that I like best. You know what I mean? It's like, all right, there's a few more moody songs I could have included. There's a few more Wings things I didn't want to do because I didn't sing the lead on Silly Love Songs and listen to what the man said. You know what I mean? Let him in. I didn't do that.
But yeah, but you were there, man. You were there.
Yeah, but I can't sit there and sing them songs. I can sit there and play songs. I can play my parts. I can add them to whatever I'm doing as a sort of an intro or something. But usually, you know, I do the songs that I like doing, the songs I actually like to play. And these are usually, you know, my songs. I mean, I'll do stuff like No Words and Deliver Your Children, things off the albums, yeah, because I wrote them or co-wrote.
You wanna give your love away and end up giving nothing. I'm not surprised that you're back.
As I say, I'm not like a hit machine, you know. It's like, that's not what the show's all about. So the songs that I'm doing, I actually like of my own song. And that I've learned over the years just by practicing. I mean, like, you know, you're sitting at home and you want to practice a bit, and then you'll sing a song that you know a little bit. Then eventually you get to know the song really well. So these are the songs that I put in the set, the songs that I know the best. Let's put it that way.
This misbelieving is a mixed up mess. You say you're leaving if I don't confess. We get along so bad, so I suggest you just ask the people and walk away before you know. Ask the people, are you sorry if you go?
I want to jump back for a second to the time after you had left the Moody Blues to the Electric String Band and how you feel now about its role in maybe having inspired the Electric Light Orchestra, which came along after that. I guess the guys were in the Move when you were in the Moody's, or that was after you left the Moody's. That was about that time.
Exactly.
And I just wondered if the Electric String Band had any role in inspiring them to do what they did.
I don't know. I would imagine so. But at the same time, you know, we were all influenced by the George Martin connection to the Beatles, you know. That was the string thing, right? Or the orchestral thing. Now, when I did my Say It Don't Mind song, John Paul Jones was the string arranger on that.
He,
well, he's a session guy, but he played bass, but he also wrote string parts.
I realize that I've been in your eyes some kind of fool. What'd I do, what I did, stupid fish, I drank the pool. I've been doing some dying, now I'm doing some trying.
Well, no, it was a trio, a rock trio, with four string players, all from the Royal Academy of Music. And they weren't that available because they were touring the world a lot of the time. So that was a bit restrictive. But at the same time, I did go and do, you know, for about a year, I did some sort of sets. I played behind Jimi Hendrix once, mm-hmm. I mean, on the same show. He even gave me a compliment.
Because well, that's cool.
It was the first time that I think, that I know of, that anybody had done that live. You know, that's what I mean. I mean, it was the first time people were using pickups on their violins and their cellos. I mean, these guys had no clue about that. So it was a learning process. It worked. All the Beatles were in the audience, and Peter Asher is still a friend of mine. All in the audience went, yeah, you know. So I did that. Bev Bevan, for me, Ello, was in our original band, The Diplomats, in Birmingham.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. So he was the guy. John Bonham used to come and watch us because of him. When he was a kid, he used to come and watch us up in that area. So anyway, Bev, of course, when we added a hit, we go now. He was sitting at home all upset because he didn't stay in the band. Because I says, anybody who wants to stay in his band's got to move to London eventually because it's where the business is. Right, anyway. So that's all started up. And I actually did get together with a few people up there at one point to sort of do something like that. And it was based around a lot of people from Birmingham. It was pre-ELO, but some of the guys ended up in ELO. So. Anyway, I walked away from that eventually. I thought, no, it was not quite right for me. That's when I started the Electric String Band. But, you know, like I say, I wrote that song, Say You Don't Mind, purely because of that. It was an audition, actually. I wanted to get a drummer and a bass player. So I wrote that song and got people to come in and play it with me. And that's how I got the members in the band. So that's the way that went. Something I always wanted to do. I was involved in the folk scene at the time. I was doing some solo-ish stuff. And that led to that. And then I met a lot of people in the folk world, like Paul Simon. You know, so I was a part of that British folk scene. Like I say, it developed into that. But then when they went on tour, I was out of work for a bit. And then Ginger Baker and all that stuff.
Yeah, I saw you did work with Ginger Baker. What was that like?
Well, I've known Ginger again since the Chuck Berry tour. Him and Jack were in the band that opened on that tour. So I knew him from then. I was down at Traffic's Cottage once and with Trevor Burton from The Move, actually. We were hanging out together and stuff. So went down there, it was Steve Winwood's birthday, and Ginger and Eric were there, and I sat and played with them a little bit. So anyway, eventually Ginger came to one of our parties, and he asked me if I wanted to join him in this new idea he had, which was the Air Force. So I did. But, you know, it was kind of, and Trevor and Alan White got involved in that, and it was just a something to do, really. And I
was such a fluid time in music. You guys had stuff going on all around you.
Well,
like, almost like swimming in a big stream of amazing stuff.
That's right. Well, that's why people ended up playing other people's records or joining other bands, you know. Ronnie Wood is a good example of that. He moved around all the way, you know, different bands and whatever. But because you were friends with these people. It's like Eric Burden basically found Justin Hayward for the Moody Blues just by accident because he was looking for people.
We did an episode about the Moody Blues on the podcast, and we talked about the tape and everything. Just, you know, it was just a local thing back then, right? It wasn't really much more than an extension of, hey, I know a guy, right?
Well, it was all about that. We all met in London, a lot of the bands, or on the road.
Right.
I mean, we used to double with people like the Yardbirds at Marquee Club. So, I mean, got to know them, you see. It's like that's the way it was. It was friendly competition, but at the same time, you know, you always ended up in a club somewhere, you know, watching some American band that's just come over to be noticed. It was a society of out-of-towners, really, that came to London, mainly because of the business and because it was really the roots place, you know. It was like the roots of all the blues-type bands, of influence bands. So,
and a crossroads for everybody to connect there, you know.
Correct, that was it.
In the middle of all this, how do you connect with Paul and Linda and start working on Wings?
Well, that's because I knew Paul. Simple as that. And we did the Beatles tour, second tour. I don't know. But we got friendly with them in Birmingham, actually. But when Bev was in the band, we did a double with them, open for them in Birmingham. You know, met them, went in the dressing room, met them. And then kind of in London, we all met up in a club. We were all very, very new to town, and so were they. And so, hey, come on over. We sat with them for a couple of hours, and then eventually, you know, they lived not far from us. George was closer than anybody. Mm. Got to know them, go to the houses and whatever. And then got to know them through that, and then eventually went to one of the Sgt. Pepper things and, you know, sort of hung out with them. Went to see bands, like I said, you know. And so they would play us their acetates, we would play them our stuff like that. So because I knew them,
Paul was looking for somebody to work with, but who he knew. He didn't want to be with someone who was like intimidated or, you know,
right.
Wow, Paul McCartney. And he knew that was going to happen with me.
That would have been me. That would have been me, though.
Yeah, but you know, that don't happen in the business. Not like that. You know, we're, as far as we're concerned, we're all the same. And the fame doesn't, you know, it's for other people. It's not for us. It's like we're all part of that world, you know. I mean, we did enough years not being famous, you know, to not let fame get to you like that.
We found a good spot to take a quick break. We will again shortly resume our conversation with Denny Lane, and it is only going to get better. More from the imbalanced history of rock and roll next.
Hey, folks, if you haven't checked out Boldfoot Socks yet, go to their website and do it today, boldfoot.com. And if you like what you see and you want to place an order, you can save 15% on us by entering the code HISTORY15 in the discount box. Now, Marcus, you've had some great personal experience wearing your Boldfoot Socks.
That is correct, Ray. I am an active cyclist. After hearing Josh tell us about his experience running a race in the desert in his Boldfoot socks, I had to give it a try on the bike, and they held really well. My feet didn't feel funky afterward, and after my spin class, my feet felt great. Not all wet and yucky.
Wet and yucky, bad. Feeling bold, good. Go to boldfoot.com and check out all the styles, and they've got a wide variety of styles no matter what your mood is about your socks and colors, designs. It all fits into what you want out of a sock that holds up, and they definitely give you that support you need. I know from the times I've worn mine.
Make sure you go to boldfoot.com and use the code HISTORY15 to get 15% off of your first order.
Look, they're your feet. Be bold. As we start a new year, Marcus, it's always good to have the things we know and love so much near at hand to help us as we forge forward, right?
Absolutely. And new beers and good beers from Crooked Eye are a great way to ring in and celebrate 2023.
I can see that you see where I'm going, bro. Talking about Crooked Eye Brewery in the heart of Hapro, you got to go in and hear the music, hear the band, feel the band, including the Crooked Eye Band every second Saturday. The brews, yes, but also the Salty Vets barbecue. So delicious. Those fall off the bone ribs, everything. Matt's got this meatloaf thing he was working on the other night. I'm going in just to have a platter. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
So now you can go in and enjoy the full package, including great music, which you always get when you go in. Follow them on Facebook and stay in touch that way and find out what the latest things that are going on, including the latest brews. I had a couple of those when I was in the other night.
Right in the heart of Hatboro, Crooked Eye Brewery. And thank you for being a partner of the podcast, The Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll.
Thanks to our sponsors, Ray and Marcus, back with Denny Lane on the imbalanced history of rock and roll.
When you were writing and recording Band on the Run, what were some of your fondest memories from that time about the crafting of the songs? And did you all bring these songs or parts of these songs in, put them together?
Well, that's a long, different, few answers to that question. But the fact is, So I'm told, I don't even remember half of it. We rehearsed a lot of that album with the band.
Well, the rain exploded with a mighty crash as we fell into the sun. And the first one said to the second one there, I hope you're having fun. Band on the run. Band on the run. And the jailer man and sailor Sam were searching everyone for the band on the run. Band on the run.
Now, if you know the story, which most people do, so I don't go into it too much because I don't like repeating everything that people already know, but fact is that band
didn't turn up, or two of the members didn't turn up.
Right. It was just the three of us.
Yeah. So we because of that, we
good thing Paul could play drums a bit, eh?
Yeah, sure. Well, I can too.
Oh, but dear.
Yeah, because we make all our own demos. We have to learn how to do all that stuff. You know, keyboards, guitar, drums, bass, whatever, you know. Yeah, we ended up doing that. And because of, we already knew the songs structurally, if you like, and they were all 99% 0.9 piece songs. So I wasn't involved in the writing of that, apart from No Words, which I brought in. They were his songs. He knew them. And I kind of knew them. So we just sat down with guitar and drums and put down those backing tracks in Africa, in a studio that didn't have the latest, shall we say, equipment.
What was it like to be in the middle of that?
It was a studio with old equipment in it. That was the first thing. And then the other thing was that Ginger Baker had a studio out there. That was one of the attractions for me. I thought, well, he must know all the people out there, which he did. Went around, did a little overdub with him in his studio. But we were in an EMI studio setting, so we did the album there. And we got to know fellow Ransom Kuti in Africa 17, all those people that were the big names out there in Lagos. So we kind of hung out and partied with them. It was great. You know, we learnt about Africa music, all that stuff. We already wanted to go somewhere where we liked the music, you know. You know what I mean?
Cool.
So that would be one of the choices. And that's why we ended up going there. Picked it out on a map, you know.
What's
so
your best memory of that, your big takeaway?
Well, I mean, there's loads. I mean, you know he got busted. I mean, you know, there's like, well, he nearly got busted with and the tape stolen.
In Lagos, right?
Yeah.
You're saying? Yeah, I didn't know that.
But other than that, it was pretty smooth sailing, you know.
Great album.
In some ways. Yeah. But again, you know, we did the rest of it back in London. You know, we did most of the backing tracks there. But all the rest of it we had to do in London because they didn't have the real equipment for it. So, you know, it wasn't up to date enough. But it was great for us because it was like doing a home album. It had that feel to it. It was relaxed.
Thanks for being relaxed and telling us all these great stories
about your
days in rock and roll. Yeah. Our guest is Denny Lane on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. He's going on tour, and we've got the dates linked up on all the episodes. So wherever you're getting this episode and this interview, you can just click on a link inside there and get right to the date so you can get your tickets to see the man coming to hang and play for a limited engagement for now, at least, right?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. But I mean, don't have any plans to do anything else except this year. So we'll see how it goes. I'm enjoying it.
That's really what it's all about, beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what it's all about. You're right.
In 1982, you worked with Paul McCartney on the Tug of War album. Were you at Air Montserrat recording on the island? And what were your takeaways and experiences there? Because we've seen the documentary, read a book about it, and was wondering if there was, you know, what your experiences were and how beautiful that island was from your perspective.
Well, first of all, it was George Martin and all those people, and Jeff Emmerich set it all up, and John Burgess, who I knew too from EMI. So we felt pretty much at home there. You know, it was just a Caribbean version of Air Studios, really. So, but the fact that all those people came in, like, you know, Ringo came in, and, you know, all those great people came in, Stevie Wonder and stuff. Yeah, there's a few memories there, but generally speaking, it wasn't looked upon as like being a wings thing. It was just us wanting to play with people we liked, or Paul mainly. But, you know, so that was it. We just invited people over to do it, and good little jams with Stevie, like, and Ringo came in, you know, and I knew him anyway. So it was pretty great. And Carl Perkins was the sweetest guy ever, you know. So these are people that you always admired, you know. So to just be around them was inspiring, to say the least. Ebony and ivory live together in perfect harmony, side by side on my piano keyboard. Oh Lord, why don't
But you know what? They learned a lot from us too, and I found this out from, to go off the subject a little bit, but Taj Mahal, I was playing him something, and he says, "Oh yeah, sounds like it. You know, you still got that sound." I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Yeah, that British sound. We used to try and copy that. We're the ones copying you." But anyway, yeah, that's kind of what it was like. You bounce off each other in that respect, you know, and you learn a lot by working with these people. It's just the way they are. And you realize that you're very much like them too.
We've talked about a number of different personalities and stuff. You mentioned Taj Mahal. Who, either inside or outside of music, is the coolest cat you ever met?
Oh, God. I wouldn't want to make that decision. Because there's a lot of people that, you know, it's like they're all into different things. They're like, as I say, Don Everly would be amongst them, you know. And Paul, obviously, or all the Beatles, because they were, you know, it's just, we were all
the Beatles.
Well, yeah, but we didn't think of them as the Beatles. It was just a bunch of guys. If we didn't like them, we wouldn't have hung out with them.
Yeah, but you felt that way because you were in the Moody's, you know?
Yeah, that's right, but we didn't think of ourselves as being big time either. It just wasn't like that. We thought, well, you're only as good as your last record. What are we going to do now? You know, that's what was going on. Yeah. We weren't part of that big machine of, like, you know, fame. It was not like that. When you look back, it was, but when you live in it, it's not like that at all. It's just, it's a hard grind trying to stay there, you know. So you spend all your life getting there, and then you suddenly run out of material. Now.
You know. Well, you know, there are many ways, and many artists who have stories of inventing and reinventing and reinventing themselves through the decades. And the real thing that people sometimes ask themselves is, okay, I'm going out to do this. Why? And you've done so many amazing things in your career. Marcus was asking you about a couple of them earlier. But the fact of the matter is, your motivation here seems purely to get out, play some of your songs, the songs that you love, for the fans who are most loyal to you. That's for sure. Right. In that setting, it's going to be tough to get a ticket if you're not quick.
That's really it. But, you know, the other thing, on a funny note, is that a lot of people don't even know I was in the Moody Blues. Especially hardcore Moody Blues fans from, you know, the second Moody Blues.
Right.
So they don't even know that I was in. Some of them resent that I was in it.
What?
That's unbelievable. Yeah, they don't get it. So it's like, I like to go out and say, you know, play songs that I was part of, and say, this is where it all started. You know, Justin and John didn't come in and change the Moody Blues. They came in with the songs, and they came with a new lease of life. But we were doing all that sort of stuff before. You know, we had that sound. We had that kind of style, if you like, before they even came along. And I'm getting that across more to people now. But even so, you know, my influence is there. And it's the same with Wings, you know. You automatically are adding something to something that you don't even know you are, but that's
right.
It's always there, you know. So it's part of the growth of something. So I enjoyed that from that point of view.
I read an interview you did a while back where you mentioned that gypsy jazz guitar is dear to your heart. People like Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli. When did you first hear gypsy jazz guitar, and what drew you into it?
I was at school when I first got a guitar. It was a cheap little acoustic guitar. And I took it to school once, and I was like, I don't know how it came about, but I was kind of in class playing guitars, and after class, and some kid come up to me from another form, we call them forms, and said, "My brother's a jazz guitarist." I said, "Good, does he know how to tune a guitar? Because mine's just tuning it the way I feel like it, you know." "Oh yeah," so he told me,
then I looked into some of that music a little bit. Mind you, I was brought up in a lot of authentic, you know, indigenous style music as a kid because my family were into all that. My old man.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
My old man even had some gypsy roots. There was my sisters, they had all their style of music, and it was very, very varied from classical to everything, you know, else. And so I was already influenced by it. And of course, during the war, before I was born, they all had a piano in the house. Everybody did. And everybody entertained themselves. So you always, you know, if you come from Birmingham, you can bet everybody had a piano. So anyway, I started to learn all that stuff. Like the sort of music that Django plays, which is basically standard jazz pop songs, you know, like Bill Bailey and all that stuff, you know, and you know, and they just jazz that up, just like everybody jazzes all other kinds of music up. So anyway, I got into that a little bit then. And then left it alone. But then when I went to live in Spain, I took up flamenco guitar. I had a friend who taught me a few licks on the flamenco guitar. Hanging out with the gypsies, learned a lot about that. And then only recently, in the last couple of years, got back into the gypsy jazz thing more. You know, because I knew a little bit about it and I was using it to practice. You know, it's very good practice to practice all that stuff. But you have to learn their thing. It's like learning the blues. Certain notes you can and can't play. It's the same thing. And you have to learn all them rhythms and everything else, which you weren't brought up on, but you're an outsider looking in. So I was pretty interested in doing that with a lot of different styles of music. And gypsy jazz was the obvious one because it's the one I started with. That and folk music.
Everything comes full circle. Hey, Denny.
Yeah, yeah.
Denny Lane, our guest on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll podcast. It's just so good to talk to you. And I, as a fan of the Moody Blues, big time, I knew Go Now. You know, when you're a young kid and you're absorbing rock and roll without the internet, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I put it all together and I'm like, holy shit, man. You know, this is the guy, you know?
Well, we never had any way of finding things out except, you know, we used to get records somehow from somewhere, you know what I mean, and you put them in your set and everybody would try and steal those records off you so they could do it.
That's what they could
you couldn't go on the internet and get anything, you know, it wasn't there.
Right.
Oh, it was fun.
Yeah, it was part of the fun of the hunt.
That's
right? The records, you know, everything else. Yeah.
Now everybody knows everything. They know too much. They don't know what to do.
You know, I'm a rocket scientist, right, Denny?
I am now as well.
It's called Brian May. Maybe he could be like the lead guy.
Oh, yeah. He's the guy.
Do you remember the first record you bought with your own money or the first record you were gifted as a child?
No, I don't, to be honest. Again, I would go around somebody's house, they'd be playing your records and say, well, what's that record? And they'd have a blank sticker over the front of it so you couldn't know, it wouldn't know what song it was. And they just play it to you. Say, can I borrow that? No. You know, they wouldn't let you. It's like everybody would scour the world and find some obscure record. So I never really went. I don't even know if I bought that will be the day, but that would be one of the first rock and roll records I've ever heard.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday will I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day when I die.
And I was kind of more attracted to, because although Elvis I thought was great, but Buddy Holly being a singer-songwriter, I kind of picked up on that. I might have bought it, but I don't remember if I did. Because I don't remember buying any records. I don't know. People would lend them to you eventually, but I don't remember. I was never really a record buyer, you know, at all. Mm-hmm.
I know we don't have forever to talk to you today, but sometime if we could have you back, I'd love to just talk about your love of Buddy Holly. He's one of our favorite subjects.
Well, I did an album with Paul.
I know.
That's why. I was going to do it with all the people, American Ray, what was his name, going to be the producer. And that didn't work out because of the timing situation. But we ended up doing it. Paul ended up doing all the back and forth up in Scotland, and we did it that way. But, yeah, it was because of our love for Buddy Holly that I think everybody who started in the rock and roll game in England was influenced by Buddy Holly. Everybody.
Was he being played on the radio, BBC?
It was the American Forces Network. They had all the best music. It was Radio Luxembourg, actually.
Welcome to the show. Here we go again.
Radio Luxembourg.
Yeah, he's finished. Hey, that's good stuff, huh? Bit of solid gold for you now on the Barry Alders Show. A blast back to the past. The Doobie Doobie Doobies, the Doobie Brothers, long train running.
Right, a lot of people have talked about that to us.
It went from that to obviously Radio Caroline and being out of the 3 mile limit. That was the only way they could do it. But
did you ever go out there and go on the boat?
Yeah, I did go on that boat.
What was that like?
It was surrounded by Heineken bottles. That's all I it really was.
Did you give them help emptying them then?
No. I just remember that being surrounded by them. I went out there with a singer called Julie Grant, who I know quite well to this day, because she was a friend of the Moody's at the time, because we used to do a lot of TV and stuff with those people. And I went out there, she was promoting her song and I was promoting mine. And I always remember, look at this, like green bottles everywhere. But anyway, that's sort of fun.
Piracy, that's what's happening here, with the connivance of almost every teenager in Southeast England at any rate. We're bound for Radio Caroline, the pirate ship that for over a year has given pop music to something like 20 million listeners, as their advertising sales staff claimed.
Yeah, so Radio Luxembourg played all the cool stuff that was meant for the American forces. And so that's where we picked up on a lot of it. But we couldn't get hold of a lot of those records. So just the kind of what you didn't know, you made up lyrics and stuff. So,
right. You fill in the gaps, right? If you had to.
Then you find out years later you've been singing the wrong lyrics, but never mind.
That's rock and roll, man. That's rock and roll. I'm so glad you're coming out to play on this tour in February. Get the dates, folks, at our website, imbalancehistory.com. You can also get links to the shows near you. On the episode where we're talking with Denny Lane here on the podcast.
Okay.
Any parting words for everybody before we let you go?
Well, I'm just looking forward to seeing people who don't know the music that much. I mean, obviously, I'm looking forward to seeing people who do know the music, but the ones that don't know it, if they go away happy, then I've done, you know, a good job. That's the main thing, because the songs should speak for themselves, you know, not your fame or what they expect you to do. It's just that's one of those things. I'm trying to push myself as a singer-songwriter more than anything now, you know. So it goes.
And we'll leave it there, and thank you, Denny Lane, on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll.
Thank you. See you soon. Cheers, guys.
Well, Marcus, all I'm going to say is I hope we can add Denny Lane to the list of people who come on the podcast regularly to be guests, because it was so much fun to have him with us.
It was a blast, and he shared so many cool stories, which means he has more stories to share about his 50-plus years doing this rock and roll thing. Holy
closing
cow.
In on 60, dude, it's unbelievable. And you know, when he had those moments where he seemed to feel comfortable, that's when the good stuff comes out. So hopefully we'll have a chance to talk to him when he's not promoting a tour or something and really dig into the Wing stuff and do more on that and his role as one of the founders of the Moody Blues. So much fun. And we got it straight on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, too. I love stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And if you're in the mood to see concerts, go check Denny Lane out. He's got a bunch of dates coming up, City Wineries, as well as a few other venues. And we'll have those links posted on our website, imbalancedhistory.com.
If you're on an app listening right now, just click through to the information part, and there'll be a link there, too. So do that and be in touch through imbalancedhistory@gmail.com.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. Twitter shortened because of characters at Imbalanced Histo.
I think if they've binge listened through or followed along through all the years now, I think they probably figured out that we're never getting the RY.
You'd think with some of the changes that happened, we'd get that RY. But
come on, must give us the two characters.
You dick!
I'll tell you what, man, we learned a lot. We had some fun talking with Denny. So much fun and so many great stories. It's the stories that get me too, Marcus. Till the next time we get together and share stories and talk about all the great music that we love here in the Dark Duck Media Studios. I'm Ray Kube.
I'm Marcus Goldman.
And this is the Imbalanced History
of Rock and Roll.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.